I walk into a restaurant, Frank, 10 guys would reach for my hat. I stand up to take a piss. They clear the restroom.
You know why, Frank?
I'm Rainbow fucking Randolph! That's why!
On episode 25, we begin the director's series with Brian De Palma's sisters. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, sweet world. You're listening to episode 25 of the Cut Print Film Podcast, and I'm your host, Dave Costell.
I'm also your host, Jeff Rollins.
And I'm the other host. I'm the host with the most, if you will, Chris Evangelista.
25 episodes?
That's right, 25, over 25 hours of us just blowing into these microphones.
Babbling like lunatics.
We're utter nonsense.
A quarter century old.
I don't know if that's how it works. It's pushing it, I feel.
Century might be pushing it.
So next week will be half of a year.
Yeah.
Because it'll be 26 weeks.
Yeah, if you want to do it the mathematician's way.
Yeah, if you want to be accurate about it.
And we haven't missed a goddamn week of this shit for you people.
No, we haven't. Yeah. We've even, when we couldn't record on our usual day, we'll record on an alternate day.
Yeah, we're that committed to this nonsense.
Why don't you tell them what it is we're committed to, Chris?
I don't even know at this point. We are a film podcast, and we also have a film website. It's called cutprintfilm.com, and you should go to it, and you should read all our articles and reviews.
We probably shouldn't be telling people what we do after 25 episodes.
No, we should. We have new listeners all the time.
Yeah, you never know. You never know.
So hello, all ye new listeners. Yeah,
there's a new person born every, like, half hour, I think, and they just start listening to the show right out of the womb, I believe.
Would you like to take a guess at what the first thing my infant daughter will hear? It will be this very show.
Oh, you got to hear episode 25.
I'm going to put the headphones over my wife's stomach tonight, and she'll hear the raw cut of this before I edit it.
And then she'll leave you.
All right, okay. So this week is...
this week in film?
Not much happened.
No.
But this week on the Cut Print Film Podcast is part one of our three-part Brian De Palma retrospective.
Right. Like, and, since Go ahead. I was going to say, like, since the this part of the summer is dead, is the dead zone, if you will.
Starring Christopher Walken.
Yes, and the TV series starring C. Thomas Howell, whoever the fuck his name was. We're doing like the director series where we pick a director and then we pick three films and we talk about those three films over a period of shows.
Yeah, we'll probably keep the director series going from this point on unless a major movie comes out and interrupts our flow.
Yeah, and if, like you said, if it's a major movie, then we'll skip the director series for that week. But this is a good way for us to watch more movies that we might not have seen.
Right, and it's a good way to get you, the listener, interested in movies you might not have seen.
That's because a comment I hear a lot from people is, hey, I listen every week, but sometimes I have no idea who you guys are talking about.
Right.
So it's like,
I hear that too.
Let's get you into it. It's almost like film college.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, there. I think there's like a proxy.
Well, we're not the professors of film college. We're the janitors. We're cleaning up with Robert Loggia.
I'm Marianne. I'm not the professor.
Oh, okay.
I'm in the rest.
I like that's the earlier season. Yeah,
the first season of Gilligan's Island with and the rest.
But yeah, so this week we're talking about Brian De Palma's 1973 film Sisters.
His debut film, if you will.
And next week we're going to be talking about his film Blowout. So if you haven't seen Blowout, now's your chance to catch up and watch it, because next Monday is the episode about Blowout.
Yes, and I know you've all been waiting for the Blowout episode.
We're just going to be blow-drying our hair.
Yeah.
Straight out of that.
It's going to be unlistenable audio, so tune in and get annoyed. But first, Chris has some breaking news.
Right, so before we go into Sisters, we'll talk... What?
Off the ticker.
Yeah, it's right off the ticker tape.
Yeah. I guess you could say the quote-unquote biggest movie that came out this weekend was The Expendables 3. And not surprisingly, The Expendables 3 sucks. It is a bad, bad movie. And you can read my review of the film on cutprintfilm.com. And I don't have a lot to say about this. I'll just say, basically, I think the biggest flaw with all the Expendables movies, and this one in particular, is it does not capitalize on its premise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you grew up in the 80s and 90s as we did, and you were into big, dumb action movies, as I personally was.
Yes, me too.
The concept of having all these big action stars together in one movie, that's exciting, and that could make for a really good but trashy, fun movie. And the Expendable movies, they don't do that. They have these guys in the film, but they don't really interact. Like, it has, you know, Stallone, he's not on the screen with Schwarzenegger a lot. He's on the screen with fucking Randy Couture. I don't, who cares?
A terrific, terrific actor.
No one wants to see him on in the film. And so
Dave just pulled up the box office report.
Yeah, I can't believe
it. And I'm absolutely appalled at what The Expendables 3 opened at.
It did less than Let's Be Cops. Fourth place at $16.2 million.
Opened at fourth place. Are you kidding me?
Which this thing was murdered by piracy.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of why the film didn't open at all well is it leaked on the internet in a pristine copy like 3 weeks before it came out.
And but anybody that saw it, bad word of mouth took hold and said...
I'll agree with that because I don't... Piracy's not enough to kill a movie this bad.
No, but bad word of mouth always is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To kill a bad movie, yes. Right.
To kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. All you need is your bare hands.
I'm just saying...
It's a plan.
They have weak necks is what I'm saying.
That was a bird's neck snapping.
Yeah.
I wasn't like...
You weren't cracking up.
Like a Muppet.
I'm just saying, if Guardians of the Galaxy had leaked a pristine copy, it would have still done well.
No, absolutely, because people would have said, like, oh, you got to go see that in the big screen.
Or in 3D.
Yeah, but this...
But now Stallone's going to be, like, he has a justification for his movie bombing.
A part of me, and this is, like, the conspiracy theory part of my mind, thinks, like...
They leaked
it on purpose because they knew how bad it was, and they were like, we need to explain why this bombed, so let's just leak it.
That's a good theory.
Like, a part of me, like, I'm
That's an interesting theory.
I don't think it's true, but it could be true. You never know at this point. Yeah.
I wish it didn't leak, because then it would have debuted at, like, number 22 million. Yeah. It's still been in fourth place, and it would have been like, look, you can't fool people three times in a row with this bullshit.
Right. So,
I'm actually more stunned that Let's Be Cops opened at number 3,
yeah,
and that Giver opened at number 5.
Well, Let's Be Cops made a cool $9 million. It had a $17 million budget and pulled in $26.2
million. I am shocked that did that well, because that looks atrocious. And it's, yeah, so who knows? I guess people like stuff like this. I don't know. What do I know?
These people.
Okay, so, I mean, we're talking box office right now.
Right.
It's a box office, not hour.
Please segment. No. Well, I don't think I can take an hour of box office talk.
No, but... How is the budget for The Giver $25 million? Isn't that a little outrageous?
Studios often, they lie about what their movie costs. Sometimes they adjust up, sometimes they adjust down. It's never, you're never going to
get it. They used a lot of CGI for all the giving that was done in the film.
All the wrapping paper was CGI'd for all the gifts The Giver gives Jonas, I believe.
All right.
Why didn't they go out and buy real wrapping paper? It looks cooler this way.
Okay, back to Expendables.
So,
snap back to reality.
Goodness.
So, the first Expendables, I think, is dreck. I didn't care for it. It was a wasted opportunity. The second Expendables, not a good movie, but I enjoyed it because pretty much everything the first Expendables did wrong, the second one realized, oh, we need to do this a little bit better. Yeah. Slightly better.
Plus, Jean-Claude Van Damme as the villain named Villain.
Yes, his name is
really great.
His name is Jean-Claude Villain in the film.
And he's fantastic. He's one of the few people having a lot of fun in the role.
He fully embraces this premise, and he has a great time playing a bad guy. There's a scene where he kicks a knife into someone's chest.
Yeah, it's great. It's really fantastic.
So the second one, I was like, I liked the second one, quote unquote, around like. It was watchable. So I won't say I was looking forward to the third one, but I liked the idea that the third one had Mel Gibson as the villain. Because, as I've touched on before in the past, I like Mel Gibson no matter how much of a lunatic asshole he is in real life.
Yeah.
I still think Mel Gibson is a good actor.
His presence on screen is generally welcome.
Right. He's a welcome presence. It's a good way of putting it. So, I was like, oh, Mel Gibson as the villain. I hope he's just like a crazy villain in this movie. And he's barely in the movie. And I said this in my review, but a part of me thinks that Stallone has such a huge ego that I feel like Gibson probably had more scenes, and Stallone was like, oh, he's clearly
that makes sense.
Because Mel Gibson, unlike everyone else in The Expendables, Mel Gibson is actually a good actor.
Yeah.
So he was probably like, oh, I need to cut out all these good acting scenes so it doesn't distract on how awful everyone else is in this movie. So it's a wash from beginning to end. Harrison Ford is fucking...
Is he sleepwalking again?
He's like a zombie in this movie. I think like he's just been zombified and put in a film. He's just...
I can't wait to see him in Star Wars because I have a feeling he's going to be bad. Like he's like almost ruined the movie.
Like, I hope he's not.
He's going to be the Nimoy of... of the Star Wars 7, and then you probably won't see Harrison Ford again.
I don't know.
Harrison Ford comes off now as a guy who just hates being an actor. Yeah, right. He has no interest in being in films anymore.
He seems like a prick.
Yeah. I think he's just tired of life.
Probably.
He's waiting to die.
Not even that. He just seems like sick of going on the fucking Conan and then he probably broke his own ankle.
It's probably because like he's had such a long career and all anyone wants to talk about is Star Wars. Yeah. So he's probably like, oh.
No.
Hey, did Han shoot first? I don't know. Why don't you go eat poison?
He probably gets asked about What Lies Beneath a lot.
Yeah. It's a fantastic film.
Yes.
So does that wrap up our Expendables corner?
I had a question.
Yeah, please.
Does Mel Gibson ever scream, shut up and blow me?
Oh, boy.
He doesn't.
Aww. Only to his ex-wife.
But I wish he had, because that would have breathed some life into this fucking movie.
That would actually be fun.
That's what I wanted. I didn't want that exact line, but I wanted Mel Gibson just being...
Just crazy.
Just unhinged. I wanted a scene where he was firing two machine guns and screaming, and he had blood all over his face.
That's what I was just going to say. Naked, covered in blood.
Like, you know that Mel Gibson scream? He does it in Braveheart. He does it in a lot of his movies. He's just like... Yeah! Like that Mel Gibson...
Yeah.
Rage scream. I wanted that in this movie, and it's not there.
They put Mel Gibson through the Passion of the Christ, and then and he breaks free with a machine gun.
Yeah, he breaks off the cross and shoots all the Expendables, and then the movie
ends. Now that's a movie I would go see.
That I would see. So the Expendables, I gave it a 2. That might be generous. It was not a good film.
Well, you were saying it's all film schedules. They can get Randy Couture at any time, but they can't get Willis and Gibson in the same
room. It's film schedule, and it's also ego, because even though these guys aren't big draws anymore, they have huge egos, because at one point, they were the biggest stars on the planet.
That's the thing. They all want to be the person being treated best on set,
right.
And when you have 12 of them. That's the other thing. Just 4. We don't need...
Yeah, there are 10 Expendables in this movie. You don't need that many Expendables at all.
I made that joke. The Expendables with Bill Murray, Bill Cosby, Bill Paxton. But if you just did 4 movies, like if you four guys
in a movie, so each character can be interesting.
Yeah, because the Expendables, they're all interchangeable. It's just like this guy, he has a knife. This guy, he also. There are 2 people who use knives in this movie, and that's their thing. Get the fuck out of here.
And they already blew the money shot last movie with Jason Statham saying, "I now pronounce you man and knife." You cannot get higher than that peak. That's as high as the mountain goes.
Oh, yeah, that's...
When Arnold's like, this car is like my shoe.
What?
That's it. That's my favorite part in part 2 where he gets in the Mini Cooper? It's like a
smart car.
He gets in a smart car and he's like...
Well, he rips the door
off. This car is my shoes. And he rips a door off.
Somehow I must have missed that line.
I have zero tolerance for this bullshit, so I really don't care. I'm kind of glad because I'm hoping this kills Expendables. Like
the female Expendables? Yeah. No thanks.
Not to be sexist, but I need this to stop. Because
like a while ago, a long time, and not to delay any more Expendables talk, but a long time ago, Quentin Tarantino was talking about making a movie similar in this vein, and it was going to be set in World War. It was before he made Inglourious Basterds. It was like the earlier version of Inglourious Basterds, where he wanted to have like Schwarzenegger in it and Stallone. He wanted to have these names in it. And it just never got off the ground. And Stallone sort of just took that idea and made his own shitty franchise. And I just imagine what someone like Tarantino could do with these big action stars. It would be a great, fun, silly, violent movie.
It could be super cool, too, if, like, in the same vein as the double feature, the Grindhouse films, like if he made it like an 80s action movie.
Yeah,
like,
that could be good.
It took place in the 80s during, like, the filming of an 80s action movie.
See, that would be fantastic, but no.
No, instead we got Stallone behind the camera.
Right, so yeah, if you...
the idea of a continuous story annoys me, too. Just reset every time with new guys. Like, you don't need... to like.
I don't mind the continuity of having the same guys, but do we need to add more people movie?
Well, this film adds six new Expendables.
What else are you going to do? You're going to make better movies. That's what you're going to do.
No, I mean, from their perspective, they're saying, oh shit, we got to do something new. Let's get Jamie Foxx.
Let's be cops.
Yeah.
So, if you like CGI helicopters and zombie Harrison Ford, by all means, download illegally The Expendables. Or go see it in theaters, whatever you want to do. Yeah. I mean, it's shit. Thanks, everyone.
Yes.
We saw it in theaters.
Not we, but...
Chris saw it in theaters.
I saw it in theaters to review it for you, the listening
God
public.
Bless you for that.
You're welcome, everyone. I didn't pay for it, though, because we're on a list, so...
Yeah, that's true. All right, so...
So we're going to get into the director series. Yeah. You want to intro this, or did we?
We have no production for this.
Oh, yeah, we're really bad at our jobs.
Directors,
the director series. Come on, keep
direct,
going.
Direct retrospective. That's it.
Direct
this thing. I think that's enough. They've heard enough.
Please, someone work on a real song for the next director series show.
Nope, you're going to get more of the same.
I meant the listening public. You can please tweet us your own version of the director's song, and maybe we'll play it on the air.
Also, tweet us pictures of your cats.
Yeah, anything
for some
goes.
Reason.
Yeah.
So yeah, Brian De Palma's 1973 thriller, Sisters.
So do you have a synopsis of this film you want to read before we get into it?
Yes, I do. Not in front of me at the moment.
I have it open if you want me to read.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. A journalist witnesses a brutal murder in a neighborhood apartment, but the police do not believe that the crime took place. With the help of a private detective, she seeks out the truth. First of all, that is a bad description.
Is that the IMDb or Wikipedia?
That's the IMDb.
Okay, yeah, I read that earlier. I was like, man, this is really cutting out the whole movie.
Yeah, that doesn't reflect what the film is about at all. So,
all right.
Do you want to... Since this is our first Brian De Palma movie, do you guys have any research on him, like, at all? You'd like to introduce him to the audience?
He's a director.
How would you know? How would they know him?
Brian De Palma has directed such films as he directed Carrie, which is like a big thing for him.
Yeah.
He directed The Untouchables. That's like a big mainstream movie he made. He's directed
Scarface,
which is probably his most popular film.
And I would guess most culturally impactful movie.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Carrie's pretty big.
I think Scarface is
Scarface,
bigger.
Scarface, the entire gangster landscape to that movie for...
Yeah, but what Carrie...
Like Al Capone loves that movie. And,
what?
And Carrie was the first...
Yeah, Al Capone loves it.
You said gangster landscape. They all love this movie.
Bugsy Malone
loves
fan.
It.
Yeah.
Nucky Thompson.
Dino Banyan. Carrie was what, 1979? That was the first Stephen King movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his first book, so.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, the modern horror movie was kind of built on Carrie.
No, I would not agree with
Halloween,
that.
Halloween, not
sure. Absolutely Halloween.
Okay.
The remake, though,
but
the Rob Zombie one.
Carrie is a fantastic movie.
No.
And, you know, De Palma's got a signature, and...
That signature is... I saw a bunch of Hitchcock movies.
I was just going to say, that signature is a piece of tracing paper over the signature of Alfred Hitchcock. And he just wrote Brian De Palma.
Yeah, so...
In the same handwriting.
Brian De Palma... At the end, though.
Brian De Palma tree. So, Brian De Palma, he's like the sleazy Hitchcock, basically.
Yeah, he's a pulpy Hitchcock.
Right.
Which is why I like his early... I like his work from the 70s.
There's a lot of Brian De Palma movies I like, and there are a lot that I will not touch with a 10-foot pole. So,
or even an 11-foot pole.
Yeah.
Did you get a little bit of bad, like... Or... Not bad, but, like, it felt like cheap Polanski, too, at times. Like, it felt a little Rosemary's
Baby. I would say Polanski
baby.
Takes a lot from Hitchcock as well, but I think Polanski is more subtle about it.
Polanski's also, I would call him a masterful director.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas De Palma is just a good director at best.
Well, did you see the parallels between this and Rosemary's Baby?
Not really, but why don't you enlighten me?
Just like, specifically the scenes where like it kept like zooming in on her face and she's screaming in bed. Like,
okay.
I was like, this
but
is starting to feel.
But I feel like that's a little Hitchcockian too with Psycho. And
right.
I mean, that whole... There's a scene. Why don't we run down the plot as it really...
The real plot, IMDb one.
I sidetracked the plot discussion.
So, first and foremost, if we're going to talk about a film this homages to, it would be Rear Window.
Yep.
Because that's the big part of the plot. Mm-hmm. So,
and Psycho.
Yeah.
Well, there's a major scene.
I would say
it's a crossover
of the two.
It's Psycho and Rear Window. All right, yeah. So who wants to break it down?
All right, well,
break it down.
I was waiting for someone to do this.
Margot Kidder stars as is she Danielle or Dominique?
She is foremost Danielle.
Okay, so she stars as Danielle, this French
Canadian.
Yeah, French Canadian. And she's a Siamese twin who was separated.
He even says that. He's like, I thought you were French. He's like, French Canadian. Yeah. And you see, like, he looks disappointed.
As we all are every time we hear that. So she plays this Siamese twin who was removed from her sister. And the film opens very strangely
in a game show.
Yeah, yes, it was awesome. The film opens in a game show called Peeping Toms, it's called. And Margot Kidder is playing this character who's pretending she's blind, and it's a hidden camera show where she accidentally, walks into a men's changing room and starts getting undressed, and there's a man in there, and the whole gist of the game show is the audience or the contestants have to guess, will the man tell her that she's in the men's changing room? Will he leave, or will he just sit quietly and watch? So that's how we open, and
this also has nothing to do with the movie.
Absolutely nothing. It's inconsequential completely. But after the game show's over, the man that was featured asks her if she wants to go to, what is it, the African room.
Well, he wins, for being on the game show, he wins a dinner for two at the African room.
Right. And so
which is as racist as you'd imagine it to be.
Is it ever?
Because
zebras.
He's also African-American, which you point out.
There's fucking monkey noises and bongos.
Bongos. Nobody's got a shirt on.
I thought that was actually a nice touch because he looks at it says like the African room and it cuts to him and he's an African-American actor and he just looks like bemused and also like fucking white people.
Yeah.
Like that's the look he's given.
So he asks Margot Kidder if she wants to be his date, and she says yes.
No, she asks.
Oh, she does?
Yeah, she's like, hey, yeah. I'll be your date to the African room.
And he says, why not?
Because she makes that, this is actually a funny line, which is like, I have my own cutlery.
Right, because she wins a box of knives, so.
Yeah, and so they go to the African room, they have dinner, and then he takes her home, and they sleep together. Cut to the next.
Little the old in and out.
Yes, a little in and out, a little out and in. We don't know.
They go to In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah. They get an animal style.
Then it's her birthday, and they act like they've been together for a long
time. Yeah, yeah. The next day is she tells him that it's her and her sister's birthday, and her sister lives with her. So he goes out, he gets a cake. He has the cake decorated to say.
Oh, and he gets her some pep pills, too.
Yeah.
So what happens is while he's sleeping, he thinks he hears the sister, Dominique, come in and have an argument with Danielle.
Right, and let's just spoil that right now.
Yeah, so yeah.
They're the same person.
They're the same person in the film. Or are they? Who the fuck knows? So
her sister was separated at birth and she died.
She died on the operating table. Out. So,
but she's got mental problems and she has split personality and she talks to herself as if she's her own sister. That's the crux of the...
Right. Yeah.
What do you call it? The psychoanalysis part of the film. But, so yeah, the next day she sends him out to get her pep pills.
Right.
And he decides to get her a birthday cake. He has the cake made out to Danielle and Dominique. Brings it back.
Oh my God, there's this...
Go ahead.
There's the scene... Okay, so it's when he's getting the cake. And it's split screen. And it's her... No, it's not split screen. It's her writing the cake out, and it goes H, like, happy birthday. She writes the H, and then it cuts to her in the bathroom on the floor. Like
she can't find her. She had one pill left, and he knocked it in the sink like a buffoon.
Yes.
She's writhing.
Because he's a boob.
It's like 30 seconds of her writhing, like, then it cuts back to the cake, and it's like, A.
I love that. I thought that was great.
And then it's back to her in the bathroom, back P. And I was like, are we going to do this all the way to Dominique?
I was kind of hoping they were. I was wondering, like, why is this movie 17 hours long? My copy was 17 hours.
You have the director's cut where they write every letter on the cake.
Yeah, he gets the cake. He takes it back. He can't find her, so he cracks the door open to the bedroom, and he sees what he thinks is her sister that he hasn't seen yet laying in the bed, and he comes over with an enormous knife.
Yes, and the cake, which in itself is just creepy. Like, if I'm sleeping, don't sneak up on me with a cake and a knife.
Right by my face.
Yeah.
The knife is pointed at his face, And he lowers it and bends down to the bed, and
she grabs the knife
and stabs him in the throat.
And blood and paint comes out of his body.
Yes,
Elmer's paint.
Yes, they're using a can of bear paint from the Home Depot.
Unmixed bear paint comes out of his body.
If she didn't stab him, he was going to die in the next 10 minutes anyway, because his blood was coagulating already.
Yeah, and it's just the oil resin on the top of the can of paint.
And blood aside, it's actually a cool little, because she stabs him in the face. She stabs him
it's brutal. Yeah, it's so. You're cringing when you're watching it.
Right.
But that was one thing I did like about the film. The fact that they used the 70s gore with that bright red paint as blood. I really enjoyed that.
It's like the Dawn of the Dead blood, where it's just like fluorescent red. Like, blood does not look like that.
So he's dead.
So meanwhile, while he's being killed, the film then cuts to a completely different character, and this is sort of also a psycho parallel, where you spend the first half hour of the film thinking it's about this sister and the guy she's dating, and the whole movie actually becomes about this reporter, played by Jennifer Salt,
she's made of hair, correct?
Yeah, she.
It's a hair in a dress. It's hair in a dress.
She's wearing the She's wearing the mask that Chewbacca wore in the Star Wars films, but with the face missing and just the hair part.
Yes, she's wearing a Kentucky waterfall hair piece.
So she's a reporter for the Staten Island. It's some like Staten Island rag paper she works
for. The Panorama.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that. Something. And so she witnesses the murder and. Since she's like a muckraking journalist, the police hate her because she wrote a story about how about police brutality.
Corrupt, yeah, it was police brutality. Calls,
I'd like to report a murder. I'm Grace Collier.
And then she goes, yes, that Grace Collier. Like, the operator instantly knows who she is. Like, oh, this bitch.
And she's like, that doesn't matter right now. There's a murder.
She's like, I write it as I see it, detective.
Yeah, see?
So
I call him as I sees it, see?
A fucking argument over her prose.
So the cops are hesitant, but they show up anyway, and while the cops take forever to get there, by the time they get up there, Danielle and her, you think it's her...
Joseph Goebbels.
Yeah, Danielle and Joseph Goebbels.
her quote-unquote husband, who is like this tall, creepy...
Always wearing leather gloves.
Yeah.
Yes, he's wearing his driving gloves, and he's got a thin mustache.
It's actually her doctor who's in love with her.
Dr. Emil
Brenton. He's played by William Finley, who's an actor Brian De Palma uses a lot.
And he's pretty good in this role.
He has a good presence, because he looks weird. So he doesn't have to like do a lot.
But
they hide the body in a couch, basically.
Which
is creepy.
Very creepy. Right. The thing I liked about that whole sequence is De Palma uses Hitchcock's split screen style, where you're watching both things happen at the same time. You're watching the murder being done, and you're watching Grace, what's her name?
Collier, I think.
See from her window Philippe, the murder victim, reach up and touch the window,
and it's so well done.
It's fantastic.
It's cool.
It's probably the best part of the movie.
You don't get this type of thing in movies that often, where you have to change the way you're thinking about the movie because this is happening at the same time from two different perspectives. It's a really neat way to make a scene.
It keeps going for a little. It shows because then it's the response time of the police while Emil is cleaning the body.
Yeah. Right.
And that's even creepier. But he's like fucking Mr. Fix-It because he gets the Comet out and he's cleaning the carpet.
He knows really well how to dispose of bodies.
And then the scene immediately following that, when Grace and the police go up to the apartment, that is expertly done.
Right.
Where they show Emil hiding.
Yeah.
And you're watching two ends of the same hallway and they're both coming down from opposite ends and Emil hides behind a corner. It's just
that's one of those,
it messes with your brain. Like you have to,
that's
your
one of those,
brain goes inside out for a second.
That's one of those scenes in movies that I love because you don't see it that much anymore. Where you have to stop and think like, how did they do this?
Yeah,
because it's clearly they weren't using two cameras because you would see the other cameraman at the end of the hall.
Right.
So, and it the continuity matches so well that I was just like, how the fuck did he pull that off without making it look?
I mean, the movie itself aside. The technical aspect of the way this film was made is admirable.
And absolutely.
The technical aspect is
the best part of the film.
That's why I wanted to do this film first.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because it's just so clever. Like, it's a very clever way of making this film.
I would argue that this first half of the movie is the best part of the movie. Because after the whole split screen sequence and they find no body, after that whole part ends, it becomes a completely different movie, and that movie is kind of shitty.
It becomes like it's a noir detective
and it's not done well.
But not only that, it never does anything technically as well as it does. Yeah, like how far into the movie are we at this point? 20 minutes? Yeah,
probably like a half hour.
And we've seen all of the cool
I would say the only other cool spot, there's a dream sequence which is really well done because it's just creepy and weird.
It's a mind fuck.
And it has like that dreamy quality to it. Like it actually feels like a real nightmare.
Okay, so after the police don't believe that Grace saw this murder because they get to the apartment and everything's cleaned up and they don't see...
Well, she didn't see the murder, and that's something that annoyed me. She only saw the hand,
but she claims she sees all this shit she did not see.
Which would have been impossible to say.
She says, like, he wrote help on the window in blood, which I don't remember.
They don't show that to us.
And the cops show up, and they're like, oh, this is a race murder. And, like, nobody ever mentioned he was black. Like, there's, true. Like, a lot of, like...
But I'm going to forgive the film for that because all right. There was one thing I liked as far as continuity goes where the blood that Emil cleans up, Grace slips and falls in that exact same spot.
This seemed like a joke almost.
Right, it's kind of like Three Stooges.
Because she drops a cake on a man's foot.
Yeah, she comes out with the cake. She finds the cake that says to Danielle and Dominique, and that's a clue.
Right.
But she slips on where Emil cleaned the blood up with the comet powder and drops the cake.
Earlier, when Emil's walking out of the apartment, he slips and falls and busts his head and then has a bruise on his head the rest of the movie. Yeah. Like, it has no...
Well, he comes back wearing that beret to cover it up.
Yeah. It's so... It feels like De Palma at times is almost making fun of Hitchcock. Like,
nah, I don't think he's making fun of it, but De Palma was known for comedies, too.
Right.
And this I think was his first thriller.
Right. He has like
a Three Stooges
dark sense of humor.
Yeah.
But you could put Benny Hill under this at some point.
Yeah. Little yakety sax. So,
I would say like on that point, the tone of the film is one of its biggest problems because
it's uneven.
It can't settle on what it's trying to be.
So Grace Collier meets this PI
played by Charles Durning,
a slimmer Charles Durning, because he becomes an enormous hot air balloon person by the by the turn of the century.
He ate all the pies.
And his name is he's Joseph Larch. He's a private investigator.
And I wanted more of him in the movie because
he was wonderful.
That IMDb description makes it sound like the movie's going to be Grace and this detective. And
I wish
it
was.
He's in like one big scene and then he's out of the movie pretty much.
Until the very end.
Yeah, where he's on a telephone pole.
Looking through binoculars at a couch. But so yeah, she enlists the help of Joseph Larch.
Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, well, no, he's long gone at this point.
Oh, really?
And,
at this point.
I guess it's assumed that they are going to crack the case, but it really becomes about her trying to crack the case. Am I jumping ahead too far to say that she finds this, I guess it's a home for the mentally deranged?
No, I mean, that's pretty much where
her mother tells her about it.
She goes and she talks to a writer at like Time or Life magazine.
Right, Time.
Yeah.
Who wrote an article about
the
Siamese twin? That's how she finds out about it. And so from there, she goes to the mental hospital, which looks like a Nantucket beach house. Yes. It doesn't really look like a mental institution.
It's a bed and breakfast,
which it's always a great idea to go investigative reporting in a mental institution
night alone without telling anyone.
Except this mental institution is very well lit.
Yeah,
and just kind of a cozy little place to hang out.
Yeah, there's scalpels everywhere, too, in case you want to.
So she has an encounter with some of the creepy residents, and surprise, Danielle's boyfriend is the head doctor in charge. And he tells Grace that, you're a resident here.
Right.
And at this point, I'm thinking, oh, my God, is she? Like, they fooled me.
That actually would have been a great twist.
I kind of thought that for a second, too, and I was like, oh, this is going to be... Because everything, like, reading about it talked up the Hitchcockian elements of it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there's going to be some awesome,
and
like...
Exactly.
Like, Grace, get back in your bed.
I thought this was it. But no, we still have 45 more minutes of movie left.
All right, so he drugs Grace and he lays her on a bed next to Danielle, which I don't know why that's
happening. I don't understand.
But whatever. So they're next to each other, and Grace basically has a dream that also shows what happened to Danielle, but not really.
It's like it imprints herself as Danielle's Siamese twin.
Yeah, it's kind of got confusing.
Goofy,
very confused.
It's goofy, unrealistic, metaphysical nonsense that has no place in the film. But it gives way to a pretty cool nightmare where pretty much
I really enjoyed that.
Pretty much everyone in the film is in the nightmare, which is
like
actually
it's a little Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, it's kind
of
cool. And but then she wakes up and Danielle kills Emil. Because she's crazy. Basically, anytime she like makes out with someone, she becomes crazy, basically.
Well, it was like, whenever I have... not me. This is Emil saying this. He's like, I love you, Danielle, but whenever I have sex with you, Dominique comes out, and then...
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's why they've gotten divorced. Or were they even married?
I don't think they were.
It's like not a real even weird the, scene where he's like the film caressing doesn't her do, stomach.
Yeah, the film doesn't do a whole lot to explain a lot of the elements that are in it. But so a hypnotic suggestion has been placed in Grace's head that, you know,
nothing happened.
She has no memory whatsoever. And that's pretty much where we end the movie.
And when the cops come and she's like, I don't know, there's no body. And she keeps saying that.
Yeah, she's the one that placed the initial call.
Right.
And now she's saying there's no body. She has no recollection.
And then it cuts to Charles Durning on the telephone pole.
With binoculars looking at...
I don't know why he's...
incredibly conspicuous.
I don't know why he wouldn't just go down there and pull open the couch and find the body.
No, wait. There's a cow next to it.
Well, there's a cow, but then a man shows up and takes the cow away angrily. He's, like, pissed.
And then as it pans out, there's a Canadian flag to suggest that the couch is now in Canada.
Yeah. Right. It made it across the border, and therefore, I guess the murder is never going to be solved.
Yeah, because... Once a body's in Canada, they can never solve that murder.
You know, it's a sovereign nation.
Yeah.
But like...
So that's it. That's the movie.
He's on a telephone. It was so Wayne's World 2. Like,
yes.
Like Wayne's up there.
You're waiting for Garth to give the signal.
That Garth, yeah. It's one of them.
And to chase Christopher Walken into the manhole.
Yeah, because like when you think about...
I know, it was the toolbox.
When you think about the logistics, like I picture like he showed up, he saw that couch, he was like, uh-oh. He went back to his truck, he got a disguise... He climbed the telephone pole, and then he just stared at the couch
for the rest of his life.
Yeah, after the credits, it should have faded back, and his skeleton should have been up on the telephone pole holding up binoculars. And there's like a crow perched on his skull. I'm not leaving until that couch moves.
Yeah, if you take a trip to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and you look hard enough, you're going to find that one telephone booth and
you're gonna,
a skeleton. Telephone pole.
You're going to find the couch that he's staring at.
So yeah, that's Sisters.
Sisters.
What'd you guys think?
I hated the movie.
Really? You hated it?
No, I mean, now that we talked about it from an analytical film perspective, I kind of respect it a little more, but I did not enjoy it. The acting was... subpar. Jennifer Salt was bad in it.
I disagree. I liked her. I thought she was.
I think there were like
a feisty reporter.
There are like a few line reads that were bad, but I think overall she did.
There were like flubbed line reads,
right?
And it's like, why didn't you just do another fucking take? Like,
I don't know that De Palma was as respected a director that he would come to be at that time.
Also,
I don't know how much time he had to make the film.
Also, a lot of the line flub scenes, they happen in scenes that are like done in one long take.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he was like, oh, fuck this. I'm not reshooting this. Yeah. This long scene.
I will say Margot Kidder, this is the best I've ever seen
her. Yeah, she was good in it.
Ever.
She's very good in
this.
She
plays, she does a French accent, French-English accent very well.
For France,
if you didn't know that she was Margot Kidder, you would think that this is a French-Canadian actor.
Yeah.
My issue with the film is what Chris was saying, especially with that wacky-ass opening,
which I loved.
Game show.
Again,
which, oh,
I
loved
think we
it.
All enjoyed that.
I was so excited.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen this type of thing before.
Yeah. And then that first 20 minutes, it was captivating. And then the movie I got... was totally different.
This
after
is
that.
Three different movies.
It lets me down.
It's three different movies.
Yeah, it is.
It's that opening where it's like kind of lampooning the social.
It was like pulling out of itself. Like I kept imagining that the movie would keep doing that, like whoa, and like keep popping back into the game show.
Yeah,
that's what I thought it was going to do. But yeah, the beginning is a lampooning of kind of social norms, like the voyeuristic aspect of reality TV, like that Peeping Tom show could be on TV now.
Yeah.
I mean, we have worse things than that.
It was networky almost, right?
Yeah.
Like, but And then there was like weird racial stuff injected to like make a racial commentary, but it was,
it doesn't go too far, it doesn't do enough.
Yeah, and it doesn't fit the tone of the film, and it doesn't say anything about race. It's just like, it's almost exploitative. Like that, the African Room felt
from a different
out
movie,
of place.
Yeah.
And it felt funny in like the relation to the game,
right,
show.
Right, it's more satirical, like the game,
because
show.
Because what
is.
If she had won the dinner to the African Room? Like, yeah. They would... It's funny. Because it seemed like they had given this black guy a prize, and that makes a racial commentary on it.
And then from there, it becomes a detective movie where...
It loses that wackiness.
Yeah, there's no more wackiness. It becomes this detective movie where Grace and the PI are trying to solve this case that the cops just are not competent enough to handle. And then it turns into this psychological, like, Twilight Zone type film.
Yeah.
Where
it almost
she's
feels
in the mental
like it's in black and white. And it is. Aren't certain scenes filmed in black and white?
Yeah, the whole...
The dream thing is.
The dream thing is. And isn't the news clip...
Yeah, the news, like, footage is in black and white.
From that initial
report. It's like Zelig-y.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it's a very bizarre movie. I like it. I don't love it, but I like it. It worked for me for several different reasons. I like that it was three different movies. I like the gore, that 70s gore, red paint,
like,
blood.
Too.
And I loved the score. Loved the music.
Right. The score is done by Bernard Herrmann.
Who does
most of the... did Psycho.
Psycho, Rear Window.
Right. He did Marnie. He did a bunch of Hitchcock.
He did some Twilight Zone episodes too.
A little too heavy on the church bells for me.
Ah,
in certain scenes, it's like bling bong bang dong gang.
And then Scrooge opens a window and asks a boy what day it is.
What day is it?
But yeah, I love that music. It just it reminded me of a Hitchcock film, and I didn't know at the time that this was the guy that did all of Hitchcock's most famous films.
I'll tell you what, though, it got me in the mood to watch good thrillers and horror movies from the set,
like
Suspiria and stuff like that.
Nonsense that we get now, where everybody's the smartest person in the room and they're all talking techno babble.
Right.
Like, what was that film with Jamie Foxx?
Law Abiding Citizen.
Yeah, Law Abiding Citizen.
Gerard Butler.
Thrillers like that are just awful. And this film, like you said, Dave, made me want to watch great thrillers.
Yeah.
Because thrillers have lost their luster because of. They're all like law-abiding citizens.
I'm hoping you guys like Blowout, because Blowout is similar in tone to this, but it's a million times better. It's a more assured film. It's just a better overall film.
Well, this is one of his earlier films.
Absolutely.
And it shows.
And it's interesting to watch. I'm kind of interested to see, like, to do these three films like this, because we're doing
stuck around.
We're starting with Sisters, then we're doing Blowout, and then we're doing Casualties of War. Right. And it's going to be interesting to see how his technical prowess evolved over time.
We're skipping Scarface.
Yes, because...
And Untouchables and Carrie, like...
We're skipping a lot. But can... let's just get this off our chests. What does everyone here think of Scarface?
Not much.
I could... It's just bad.
I hate it.
I do not like Scarface.
I hate Scarface.
I like parts of it. I like Al Pacino's performance, even though it's hammy and broad, but...
It should not be mentioned in like a great film conversation.
No,
and
it always
gets mentioned. If you're going to mention De Palma's Best, why not mention Body Double, or why not mention Carrie?
Right.
I liked this better than Scarface, Sisters.
Yeah, it's because it is better.
Yeah, agreed.
So I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but I was somehow feeling like Jonathan Glazer was tapping into this movie a little bit with Under the Skin.
Really?
There were scenes in this that, especially the opening with like the baby and that weird opening in Under the Skin, was like the cell coming to life. And then
this is the eye.
Yeah. And then there's a scene where Danielle's walking into the apartment and she's like taking her clothes off one piece at a time.
Okay.
And dropping them, and he's following her in. And I was like,
I mean, it's certainly possible.
That's interesting. Right. And now that you're mentioning that, he probably did see this film.
Yeah.
He probably was paying tribute to De Palma.
And it's cool. Like,
it is.
To think about this movie being paid homage. Is it homage? Whatever.
You can say either or.
You know what? Say fromage. Yeah.
Okay.
It's French for cheese.
Cheese. It was cheesed.
It was Breed, I believe.
Yeah. I love a good soft fromage.
That's the cool thing about analysis, because even if he wasn't trying to do that, he did it. You know what I mean?
Subconsciously.
Yeah. And the art still has a parallel there with one of the best movies of this year.
Yeah.
So that was cool.
Yeah. I recommend Sisters.
From a purely technical level, it's definitely worth
it. Yeah, two at a time, three at a time, if you can get them.
Listen.
Just do them.
This is a Coors Light commercial disguised as a podcast. Watch Sisters, like Chris said, as far as like a technical level goes.
Right.
It's not an amazing movie, but it's definitely interesting as far as a filmmaker's technique goes. There's a lot of great split screen, a lot of Hitchcock tributes in this film. A lot of Hitchcock tributes.
Yes.
It would be cool if you're doing like a Hitchcock retrospect, or even around Halloween, this would be a good movie to watch too. Like,
we're Canada Day.
Yeah.
Boxing Day.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And I guess that's... Do we have anything else for
Sisters?
You have
closing thoughts?
There was a remake of Sisters, which I did not see. I'm just wondering if anyone had seen it.
I read that there was. Didn't see it.
I never saw
it. It's with Chloe Savini,
right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
She does not play the sister. She plays the reporter. So.
Oh.
Like, I saw that, and I was like, oh, because she...
She plays Charles Durning.
She's... At the end, she's on the telephone pole.
She's still there. That's why we haven't seen her in so many years. She's still on that telephone pole.
Did, Oh, what the fuck's his name? Buffalo 66 guy.
Oh, Vincent Gallo.
Did he direct it?
He did not direct it. It was directed by someone named Douglas Buck.
Oh, Doug Buck?
Yeah.
No, I don't know that.
He was the inspiration for Uncle Buck, I believe.
I think he's directing Ant-Man.
Okay.
He was one of the names they threw around for Ant-Man.
I recommend Sisters. See it.
Yeah. Or watch Suspiria, or any Hitchcock movie, or
Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit.
Well, yeah, you want to get back in that habit.
Well, hopefully you already watched it if you're listening to our
director series, or else you're really confused about what we just talked about.
All right, we're gonna come back after the break and talk about some of our favorite Robin Williams movies.
Yes.
And
we're gonna bring it down just a little bit because
Make sure nobody leaves happy.
Yeah. Send them home sad. That's our motto.
It's going to be a real bummer at the end. So
get your hankies ready.
Here at Cutprint Film, we do our very best to keep you in tune with the movie industry. We're revolutionizing the way you read movie reviews by putting them on the internet. Go to cutprintfilm.com and we will guarantee you a pleasant experience. We're breaking new ground every day to bring you the finest material possible. We've partnered with such clients as MoreLikeRadio.com, AntiFanboy.com, and Joystick Jerks, the podcast. So check out all of that and more on CutprintFilm.com. And remember, have a Cutprint Film day.
Welcome back, everyone.
Cutprint Film Podcast has returned.
And we're all upset.
Yes. Yeah, we should have, maybe we should have opened with Rob Williams, because this is like the sad part, but whatever.
Yeah,
we'll try and make it not too sad.
Yeah, because this is, we're going to be talking about our favorite Robin Williams.
Yeah, this is a celebration of his work, not like, we're not going to like obsess over his untimely death. So.
No. But the only negativity will be when we joke about his terrible roles.
Yes.
Which is fair game.
Yeah, there are plenty of terrible roles for Robin Williams.
Specifically in the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah, he ran into some dreck.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say the roles are terrible. It's the films he's in that are just...
Yeah, I'm not saying he's bad.
No.
He's actually pretty good.
Yeah, like,
in
so
mostly everything.
Robin Williams was a spectacular actor. I think... people think of him primarily as a comedian, but he went to Juilliard for acting. He was primarily an actor who just happened to be funny.
Yeah.
So it's not like a lot of like stand-up comedians, they start as stand-up comedians and then they like sort of become actors. And that was sort of the opposite for him.
Is he the only like stand-up comedian who's also a trained actor? I can't think of any other one.
I wouldn't say he's probably not
Eddie
only,
Murphy?
But he's probably like the most
Eddie Murphy's not trained.
No, like not the way, like Eddie Murphy did not go to Juilliard. So, I mean.
Jeffrey Rush. No, I don't know.
Jeffrey Rush live at the Apollo.
That stand-up comedian Jeffrey Rush.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's an insane accomplishment for a human being. And then the other thing, a lot of people, this is one of the first things people around you probably started saying too, like, oh, why'd he kill himself? Like, right. He had so much going for him.
Right.
And it's like, Robin Williams was famous pretty much his whole life, his whole adult life. So to him, it was just that's normality, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Normalcy.
And I mean, and again, not to get too much into the misery part of it, but when you have depression, you don't have like clinical depression, not like I lost my keys, I'm depressed. When you have like real depression that you need medicine for, your mind doesn't work like, oh, I'm also a millionaire actor. You're just miserable and you need some way out. So, yeah. I mean.
So that said.
Yeah, that now that that's out of the way.
I mean, we've all been depressed, but like the thing that gets you through that is like, all right, in a couple days, I'll feel better.
Yeah.
And then if that, like, could you imagine like that feeling just never ending? Like,
no.
It would be like living. I said this to someone, but it has to feel like living with like an open sore.
That's probably like, a good way to put it.
Why am I alive? This hurts.
Not to get this, like, again, I don't want to keep talking about this and make it too personal, but I know exactly what it's like because I have clinical depression when I'm on medication for it and everything. So it sucks. So,
yeah, I mean, what can we really say?
We are not doctors. We're three buffoons who talk about movies.
Exactly. We watch movies.
Yeah.
And Robin Williams was in movies.
And that's what we're going to talk about.
That's why we're talking about him.
But he wasn't just in movies. He was like a he was like a force.
He's like your favorite uncle. And I think that's why this death has I can't remember the last time an actor's death affected so many people like this. I mean,
different age groups,
like,
as well.
Every time an actor dies, there's always a vocal majority who's like, I can't believe that person's dead. But with this death, it's been wide sweeping. And he's sort of like because he's had a career for like 40 some years. So as long back as most people our age can remember, just Robin Williams was around and in movies.
Yeah.
And he's like that. Yeah. He's like your uncle, your goofy
and
uncle.
He was so positive.
Right.
Like, Russell Brand described him as like a beam of light, like just poor, like something from a different universe was ciphered through Robin Williams in a way that we don't get from anyone else.
No. And like Chris said, he's been around for nearly 40 years in the public consciousness. Most older people got their first taste in Happy Days when he was portraying Mork.
Right.
And then he went on to his own series.
Right.
He wasn't Fonzie?
No, he was not Fonzie. That was an actor named Arthur Fonzarelli.
Fonzie was a real person. He just wandered onto the set and they built the show around
him. Hey, Art.
Art, the lesser nickname.
So yeah, since 1978, people have been familiar with Robin Williams' antics,
right,
for lack of a better word.
It's a good word.
They are antics, yes.
And I mean, people knew him as Mork. That was his most popular role for a while, and that's what I knew him as first growing up because of Nick at Night reruns of Mork and Mindy. But he also was a fantastic dramatic actor.
He was, and I actually...
Fantastic dramatic.
Yeah, I'm one of those weirdos who I actually prefer his dramatic work to his comedy.
Because as I got older, I kind of... The manic nature of his comedy was not really my cup of tea.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would never say Robin Williams is not funny, because that would be stupid, but it's just not my type of humor. Like, that's...
It's like stream of consciousness.
That, like, motor mouthy, like, it gets tiring after a while. So, I mean, for me.
But
that was something to be... Like, because people try to replicate that thing you're talking about, where he could be like, he could just riff off of anything. This isn't improv. It's like
his mind,
it's a state of mind.
He had his mind worked differently than other performers.
He could flip it into a fake Shakespearean role and then be like, and then all of a sudden would be a donut shop employee into like a telemarketer.
And I think that's where the Juilliard training comes into play.
Yeah.
He can set a scene expertly just with his words.
At the drop
of a dime.
And I heard, I don't know, I can't remember, there's been so much Robin Williams talk, but there was something where the animators for
Disney's Aladdin
were complaining because they couldn't keep up with Robin Williams. And if you think about it, like, how much of that wasn't scripted?
All of it.
Like, yeah. The fucking, also makes Julian Fry. Like, that's like...
Literally, all of it was not scripted. They had to animate around his dialogue. Yeah, basically, he did the dialogue first.
And that's how, what sets that movie apart. Mm-hmm. I feel like we should start with Aladdin because, I mean, we're not going to do every movie.
But, no, that would take a long time. So, I think Aladdin is like that one movie where a lot of kids became aware of Robin Williams. Because that was like the first time...
Yeah.
He crossed over into like a movie for children and, you know.
And I don't know if he ever...
Also, Mrs. Doubtfire.
Mrs. Doubtfire and Aladdin, I think, are like the two big ones.
And they're 92, 93. They're back-to-back films.
Yeah, and especially for children of divorce, Mrs. Doubtfire was a big movie. Because you're like, oh my God, this is happening to other people.
Right, and just like in my life, my dad's a sociopath and he dressed up like an old woman.
You brought a petting zoo home to your house.
Fake tits caught on fire. It was real weird. But I don't know. I feel like it never gets better than Aladdin for me, just nostalgic-wise.
Really?
I'm a huge Robin Williams fan, but that just...
You think that's like his best role is what you're saying?
It's just the most important to me,
okay.
I would say.
Like when you think of a Robin Williams role, you think
immediately
of
Aladdin, think of Genie.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
I'd say that's fair. That's I think of The Birdcage immediately when you say Robin Williams, just because it's got that drama aspect to it slightly, but it's also that wild comedian... nature that he had, where it's not too much. Like the motor mouth kind of works in that movie.
Yeah, and it's not.
And it's not like well,
it's not every.
Yeah, yeah.
Birdcage was an interesting movie for me because my father was not a guy who liked comedy, but Birdcage was a remake of a French film, and he loved the French film. Mm-hmm. And two things my father did not like were comedy and going to the movies. But he wanted.
Naturally, that's why you're on a comedy movie podcast.
But. He wanted to see that movie. So I went to that movie with my father, and The Birdcage is the only time I remember seeing my father laugh at a movie. And like,
wow.
That's like a powerful thing that Robin Williams was able to make my father laugh. And because I don't want to paint a picture that my father was like this humorless asshole, but he was not the type of person who laughed at movies. But that was the only time I ever remember seeing him watching a movie and laughing at the jokes.
That's awesome.
So that, I agree with like The Birdcage is like a big thing. It's like, yeah, and it's,
dramatic wise, I would say Dead Poets Society and Good Will Hunting kind of fit the same.
I'm not the biggest Dead Poets Society
fan. Yeah, we went over this earlier in the week.
Jeff's a robot.
I don't like Maudlin for the most part.
I agree that Dead Poets Society is almost sickly. Like, you'll get diabetes from that film.
It's like eating the entire sweet. Russell Stover's.
Right. But
chocolate box.
But I also like the nerdy literature slash poetry nerd in me just can't help but like love that movie. And he's phenomenal in that movie, I would say, honestly. And
keep going. Sorry.
It just goes back to like, I think the reason his dramatic work was so good is because I think I don't want to like play too much into like personal life slash. Whatever, but all his dramatic performances that are the most memorable, they have this like sadness to them.
Yeah,
and he was so good at that, and it's obvious why he was so good at that.
Yeah, I mean,
I didn't know it at the time.
Right, but,
he was an expert at portraying sadness just by facial expression
and
alone.
It's so impressive. And like, well, I think what makes his dramatic work also so impressive is like he's so known for being like manic and spastic and like. All over the place, but when he does a dramatic role, it's so quiet and subtle, and it's like you can't believe it's the same guy who's like running around spewing a million jokes at once. And I think that's another reason.
So specifically, 1 Hour Photo.
Absolutely,
and I'd say World's Greatest Dad.
He's excellent in that as
wonderful.
Well.
Wonderful.
I'd say going back to this, but all of the emotional weight almost of Good Will Hunting rests on Robin Williams.
Oh, he's the best part of the movie. Like, I don't really give a shit about Matt Damon's character in that movie.
But it's insane because without Robin Williams, like no other actor, because that's a role in a script, but I don't feel like any other actor could have filled that role.
It would have lessened the role had another actor, but it would have just been a side thought. Like,
and if they don't make that movie, then Matt Damon and Ben Affleck don't have careers.
Right.
So that's they owe Robin Williams everything.
Absolutely.
Because he made that movie good. And that sadness is in there. Like, his dead wife, it's like, you feel it throughout the whole performance, even before you know it. Like,
and I bet you, like, when Matt Damon and Ben Affleck wrote that script, when they wrote that character, I guarantee they were not like, we should get Robin Williams to play this guy. And
no.
I think that's another thing that just makes that performance so remarkable. I mean, he won an Oscar for that performance. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just, it's so... I don't know. And going back to 1 hour, I rewatched 1 hour photo the other night because I'm going to write a piece for it for the site. And I'd always liked that movie, but I hadn't seen it in a while. And he is so fucking good in that movie. It's like, it's almost distracting how good he is in that movie. Because that movie, that's a character that's very quiet. He doesn't say a lot. There's like voiceover narration, but it's mostly just a performance that's achieved through just, you know, facial expressions and just his. Just the way he interacts with the world around him, and that's such a dark character for him to play too, and he's so good at it. And it's just, he was an actor who could just do so much stuff, and it's, I think
he defines versatile,
right? Absolutely,
he's an excellent actor.
How do you guys feel about Insomnia?
I think he's good in that.
It's an okay movie. Chris, he's the best part of it.
I'm a big Nolan fan. I don't think that's like Nolan's best movie, but he's really good in that, and. It's interesting because that movie came out the same year as 1 Hour Photo. And in both those movies, he's playing like a quote-unquote...
Yeah, a horrible person.
Crazy guy, but they're such different performances. Because whereas...
One's a little over the top.
Like the 1 Hour Photo performance, it's like a sad sort of crazy. Whereas the Insomnia, he's just kind of just evil, really, the way he's playing that character. And
there's a lot of mustache twirling.
Yes. But
he ties a woman to the train track.
Yeah, he wears a top hat and... He's a big mallet.
What does he do, though, later in his career? After, like, World's Greatest Dad would be the last noteworthy thing, right?
Yeah, which is, I guess...
I mean, he had that show, which I never saw.
I never watched
of.
It. I guess, like, he was in Zero... It says he's in Zero Theorem. Is he any good in that? Because you reviewed that. Do you remember him in that at all?
I can't... Oh, my God. He's not even... I can't remember him being in the movie.
He's not in a lot of anything.
He mostly just started
Night
doing
at the museum. He plays Teddy Roosevelt,
And he mostly just started doing these, like, I guess, family movies all the time. And it's, I don't know.
He's in a movie called Boulevard, which I've never heard of. The Face of Love.
He was in that episode of Louie.
He's excellent.
Which is awesome.
That's an excellent.
He's another sad performance.
That whole Louie segment is also, it's like.
A funeral, right?
Yeah, it's extra depressing because it ends with Louie and Robin Williams. They go about to part ways, and Robin Williams says, like, whichever one of us dies first, come to my funeral. And it's like, this is extra miserable now.
Yeah, but it oddly feels like a suiting, like, farewell.
Yeah, like, I almost wish that was, like, the last thing he had done, because that would be, like, a perfect way to send him off, I guess you could say.
No, the last thing he did is in post-production right now. It's called Absolutely Anything, and he's credited as Dennis the Dog, the voice of Dennis the Dog.
I mean, that could be good just because the Monty Python, the living members of Monty Python, are actually in that movie. That's, like, their big reunion movie.
Mm. He has 4 movies in post right now, so... Yeah.
One of them is called Merry Friggin' Christmas.
Well, that's going to be great. Is that a Dennis Leary film?
Christmas movies are always good, said no one.
Yeah.
He's in the Night of the Museum movie. Which is called Secret of the Tomb, which probably will change its title.
I think it's called Secret of the Give Us More Money, Please.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's a
cumbersome title, too.
Yeah, I feel like in our world we can just accept that Louie episode as our last bit
like
of
the
Robin
last
Williams.
Great
yeah.
Robin Williams thing. Maybe it is. I mean,
but it can't be said enough how great he was in Aladdin. How great he was in 1 Hour Photo, The Birdcage.
Even Mrs. Doubtfire, which is a movie I've come to loathe.
I'm not a giant fan of that movie, but he is.
He's
fun,
great
at least.
In that movie.
He's fun as a lunatic who dresses in drag.
Yeah. Who would be sent to jail under other circumstances.
Yes, not only will you get your custody removed, you'll be in prison, sir.
That's a movie that probably watched that movie like a million times when I was a kid, because it was always on TV.
Yeah, I think it still is.
Yeah, it's
TBS, very funny. If you would like to sponsor us, we are available for sponsorship, TBS.
He was just, like a force. I keep saying that, like a force of positivity. And yeah. It's almost like...
It's a kick in the stomach.
It is, because he felt like one of those actors who would just always be around. Like, I hadn't really, like, said, like, oh, I wonder what Robin Williams is doing, like, but I never thought, like, he'll die soon and that'll be it. Like,
Chris has kind of been joking all week, like, oh, this is the week from hell, but it's like, we're living in a weird time, and it's like...
Oh, I'm not joking. Last week was terrible.
I mean, you're saying it.
No, I'm kidding.
In a bit of a jest, but it's like Robin Williams was like our anchor to something fun.
Yeah.
And if he can't hang in this,
yeah.
In what it just is like a bad barometer for the state of things, almost.
Yeah, it's not like. Like, obviously, Robin Williams dying is not going to be the worst thing that happens this year, but it's like, well, this year, it's like, I'm already, like, I'm done with this year, because I just want to write it off at this point.
Who do you think is going to get the biggest applause at the Oscars?
Yeah.
I hate that.
Me.
It's so tasteless. That is, we should talk about that when Oscars roll around.
We'll have to.
What a tasteless segment that is.
With the sad music.
And the applause. And they pick a break.
They pick the saddest possible film clip. It's like people crying
They always fucking leave someone out, and you're like, why? Why do that person out?
Why even do it? Your telecast is already 17 and a half days long.
Yeah, it's someone's job to put that together. Did he really fucking forget this person? Like, oh, shit. You're getting paid to do this. Just put their name in there.
But I will, in their defense, they did mute the crowd this year, so it was just, there were no applause, you couldn't hear it.
That's the best way to do it, yeah.
But I don't know, it feels, like, this is going to sound absurd, but it feels like we were sent this, like, from the comedic gods of fun and positivity, and we destroyed him. I don't know. I don't know why it feels that way, but it does.
Even though
he had his own personal issues, it just...
I think saying it's a kick in the gut is really the best way to put it, because it just sucks. And like, as blunt as that sounds, like, Robin Williams dying sucks. It really does.
It truly does
suck, because like, he was such a versatile actor, and like,
we lost a big part of the cinema.
It pisses
world.
Me off to think like we're never gonna see. Like, imagine him doing another dramatic performance. Like, imagine him working with like Christopher Nolan again. Now that. Because Insomnia was Christopher Nolan's second
Nolan
movie.
Can do whatever he wants now.
Now that Christopher Nolan has all this clout and he's improved, imagine another Robin Williams performance.
Imagine Tarantino getting a hold of him.
Yeah, imagine all
these...
He was
only 63. Like, to think what Gene Hackman did in his later... Like Royal Tenenbaums was a...
Yeah.
Like,
imagine him in a Wes Anderson movie. Like, I'm pissed that's never going to happen now.
Like, yeah, that's tough.
It's
terrible.
Philip Seymour Hoffman ruined me, because he went out, like... at the top of, and I feel like dead, like Philip Seymour Hoffman just took all of the feel out of me, because when Robin Williams died, I was like, oh, I just was like, oh, that sucks. But
I don't, like, this might sound like a little cold, but like, Philip Seymour Hoffman dying, while it was upsetting, I wasn't shocked by that, because I knew what problems he had with drugs, and Robin Williams had that too, but it just felt like it made more sense that Philip Seymour Hoffman would be the type of person who would die.
He was noticeably troubled.
Right.
Whereas Robin Williams,
he was
had
so
that
good at
mask.
Like, yeah. Like, he didn't see.
He was
it.
Like the clown.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman didn't want to die. And that's what. Like, I still watch The Master, and I'm like, this guy had so much more in him.
Absolutely.
And it hurts when I watch that movie. Yeah. Whereas, like, Robin Williams hasn't done anything in a while. So to me, it was like. It I don't know. I'm not comparing the two.
No.
But it just,
no, I get what you're
I'm
saying.
I'm just saying, like, this year has already destroyed me. That
it's not a good year for great actors. Let's put it that way.
No, it's
and they're
not.
Kind of in the same, like, realm. Like, they would play sort of the same characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it just feels like we're losing all of those good, older, male, white male characters.
Yeah.
That's all right. We have Channing Tatum.
as no one says anything.
That fucking Wes Anderson, Quentin Tarantino thing killed me.
Imagine him in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Any of these directors.
But I could see him like...
I could definitely see him in a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a rough one.
All right, well...
So Robin Williams will be missed.
He will definitely be missed.
We loved him.
Yeah, he was awesome.
And it's a damn shame. So now that you're all very depressed.
Now that everyone's sad,
let's do some movie recommendations.
We'll do a little recommendation.
Doctor's Will Weekly Movie Recommendation.
What the?
Wait.
Did you get Herman Munster back from the grave to sing that? What?
Who sang that?
That's our guest singer,
Fred Gwynn.
That was Referee Jollins.
It's like Ray Liotta.
Yeah,
it's
Ray Liotta.
That sounded just like him.
Oh, boy.
This is Ron Perlman is what I meant.
As Hellboy.
As Hellboy singing the song.
That was fantastic.
Excellent
work. I hope everyone enjoyed that out there.
It'll be a ringtone soon.
I'm going to go first this weekend.
Please do.
This weekend. Go first this week. My recommendation is the 2012 documentary Beware of Mr. Baker. It's directed by a guy named Jay Bolger. It's his only film. And this is a documentary about the drummer Ginger Baker. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's the drummer for Cream. And,
I am.
Okay.
No one was saying anything. Yeah.
Sorry.
He's a drummer for Cream and Blind Faith. You're probably more familiar with Cream. This fucking guy is out of his mind. Like, maybe one of the meanest people I've ever seen. The film opens with him breaking the director's nose with his cane.
Oh, my God.
Yes. He's attacking him in his truck with his cane. And the documentary...
He's an older gent now?
Yeah, he's... I think he's in his 70s.
He's like House. He's got a cane. And he's cranky.
And he's played by Hugh Laurie for some reason.
Oddly enough.
But yeah, he's this crazy, crazy British drummer who's amazing. He's an actual musician. He's more than just a drummer. He composes.
So he's not like Ringo.
No. No, he can keep time.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a fascinating film. He was in he's in Cream with Eric Clapton, and he's just an unbelievable drummer. And he got addicted to heroin. And it goes into his whole life story. I think he's on wife number 4 now.
Nice.
And he lives in Africa.
Oh.
He actually moved to Africa in the 80s to drum for Fela Kuti. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Nope.
He's the most famous African pop artist.
Okay.
In history, and he was a rebel against the government.
Okay.
But
an actual rebel.
Yeah, an actual rebel.
Like a teenager.
No. This guy actually protested and all that stuff. But yeah, it's a fascinating documentary, and he is such an unlikable person.
So it's fun to watch just because he's a nut.
Yes, a nut is exactly what he is. He's crazy and doesn't give a fuck about what you think about him. And he'll tell the director, "That's a stupid question. Get the fuck out of here."
You already kind of want to watch it.
He's like, "You already know the answer. I've told you that. You've asked me this question before." And the director has to tell him, "Well, the people watching, they didn't read that article. This is a documentary."
Right.
And that is kind of what prompted the fight where he broke his nose with his cane.
Sounds cool.
I love a good nut documentary.
It's really good. And this guy is such a talent. It's kind of a shame that he's not more well known. I mean, he was the drummer for Cream, which was the best band in England for approximately 1 year before they broke up and imploded.
Well, like, that was like the end of the 80s, right?
Cream was the 70s.
Was it? What was like the...
You're thinking of Milk.
Yes. You're thinking of Air Supply.
Were they... They weren't hair metal, right? No.
Cream?
No, I'm thinking of something different.
They did White Room.
Oh,
in the White Room. I'm just going to do that the rest of the show.
He's playing a trumpet with a plunger.
Take it away, Dave.
I don't know who I'm thinking of.
But yeah, that's my recommendation. Beware of Mr. Baker. It is on Netflix.
What is that even?
That is a clip from Dirty Harry.
Well, I don't remember that.
From where Dirty the main antagonist gets stabbed in the leg.
Oh.
Want to hear it one more time? Sure.
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
I'm sure we'll hear it a couple more times.
Next.
And he becomes a rooster.
He becomes Rockadoodle.
You should have got the sound effect of that guy in Sisters getting stabbed in the face.
Oh, my God. I have it right here.
Uncanny. I'll go.
At least it's not the Boogans.
Anyway, my recommendation is the 1968 film Once Upon a Time in the West, directed by Sergio Leone. I actually picked this today as today's Soundtrack Sunday on our site, Cut Print Film.
You mean yesterday's
Soundtrack Sunday. I'm sorry. I'm broadcasting to you from the past. But so this is a spaghetti western, if you will.
Mm. Any Parmesan cheese on?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's some meatballs.
And, that's a spicy meatball, yeah. Right, Dave?
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
We are banging on all cylinders.
Improv King Dave.
Oh, we say yes.
Once.
Yes, and. It's yes, and.
Yes, and.
So,
I already said Parmesan
rigatoni.
Cheese. Rigatoni. Yeah. Spaghetti and rigatoni and meatballs. Italian.
That's it. I'm done. All no. Right. So Once Upon a Time in the West, it's fantastic. It's just like an epic, sprawling, brutal Western. It's about basically this guy's trying to build a railroad, and so he sends his like hired gun in to kill everyone in the way. And the hired gun is played by Henry Fonda, and this was like a break for his kind of performance. Cause Henry Fonda usually played like nice guys in movies.
Yeah. 12 Angry Men.
Right. Yeah. And so Sergio Leone sort of used that to twist the audience expectations. Cause he's like this asshole in this movie. He like the first scene with Henry Fonda, he kills a kid. So it's like, oh, this is not what I expected from Henry Fonda. And it's just, Charles Bronson is in it, and like being his most Charles Bronson-y, he plays like a harmonica.
Death Wish.
It's a prequel to Death Wish 3.
Yeah. Well, this is Death Wish's grandfather. The character was named Death Wish in his films, by the way.
So it's a comic book film.
Yeah. So this takes place in the Old West, and then eventually his son gives birth to Death Wish.
That makes sense.
So,
No, it doesn't.
And what was your movie again?
It's Death Wish 3.
All right.
This is the. Is this the ultimate Western film?
I would say this is the ultimate spaghetti Western. This is a masterpiece. This movie. It's almost 3 hours long, but it's just, I don't know. Like,
this inspired a lot of the stuff in Django, right?
Pretty much anytime Tarantino does anything involving like Westerns and stuff like that, he's taking directly.
Even Kill Bill, he took
absolutely music from this movie, which was. I can't pronounce his name, so I'm not going to try. Ennio Morricone is his name.
Like he's the 5678s.
Yeah, he's those cute Japanese girls. He's. I didn't talk over Jeff's recommendation like this.
Things are falling apart.
Sorry, my movie isn't about fucking Ginger Baker, everyone.
No. Well, he demands respect.
I just actually know what you're talking about. So I was trying to say Cream was a hair metal band earlier.
So. Look, this is a good movie. Watch it. It's on Netflix. It's fantastic.
I will probably watch that this week.
It's really good. One of the things what Leon does with the film is he's really interested in like rituals leading up to violence. So there's a lot of scenes where there's just silence and characters are just almost like fetishizing like their weapons and loading their guns. And it's just silent and it's tense and then just violence happens and it's shocking. It's a really interesting.
Just the fact that Henry Fonda
is like the bad guy.
The bad guy. That's excellent to me.
It's an excellent movie. So it's on Netflix. I recommend it.
All right.
What is that end noise?
That's the guy getting stabbed still.
It really hurt.
It takes you completely out of the movie.
All right, let me get all my quips ready for Dave while he's
quip
talking.
Quip up.
Let me open my 101 silly joke book joke.
Henry Fonda what? Fonda you?
What? Terrible.
On the documentaries about nuts, note.
Like planters.
Yeah.
Netty people.
Fishers.
Emerald.
I'm going to recommend Dear Zachary, a movie I watched for the first time this week.
Yes.
Which is a pretty, I think it was the first movie ever on Netflix.
Maybe a terrible week to watch Dear Zachary.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're feeling blue, don't watch this movie.
Yeah, that's why I'm recommending it. It's the perfect capper for the week of misery.
For Misery Week TM. Yeah.
Would you say this film has a twist in it?
Yes. Yeah. It's a documentary with a twist.
Yeah. And,
it's a lemon-lime twist. It's delicious.
Mm.
It's a brutal documentary that just layers on the terrible. It's about a guy who
don't like spoil a lot of it, because a lot of this movie, like, the less you know, the better.
It revolves around that twist,
and
it's, which is weird for a documentary, but it works.
It's so effective.
Yeah,
it's about a guy's friend who's trying to record he's trying to capture a bunch of memories about his friend who's passed away, and it's kind of cool because this guy was apparently awesome and touched a lot of people's lives.
He's like the nicest guy in the world, basically.
It's pretty amazing how, because if you wanted to make a documentary about the people I've touched, you could do it in about 14 minutes. Yeah, you wouldn't have to drive across the country. This guy literally has to fly to like three different countries and different hospitals and just to meet people that his friend interacted with in order to capture these moments. And it's a pretty terrible film that turns into an awesome portrait of how great his parents are. They're just
they're so nice. Like, it's like, it almost destroys your faith in humanity, but then his parents are such good people. It's I can't believe there are people this nice in the world. He's like, I fully accept that there are terrible people in the world, but the fact that his parents are just so nice.
Yeah, had his parents not been like as great as they were, the takeaway from the movie would just be awful.
Like, but I honestly think if his parents weren't in the movie, it would be unwatchable, because I don't know why you'd want to watch this.
An exercise in misery.
Yeah.
You still, at the close of it, you still feel pretty terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, we've established that I'm a mechanical man, but this movie...
Here's this oil can.
Oil can.
Jeff only had a heart.
This film almost made me cry.
Almost.
Okay. And that's a ringing endorsement from robot Jeff Rollins.
This film... I am a robot. This film messed me up.
My gears. My circuitry.
Yeah, this is a great movie.
Yeah. It's. I mean, most people have seen it, but if you're like me and you've only seen 33 movies, see this one.
This is kind of like that movie Senna. Like, this has been on Netflix since the dawn of time.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And I've always passed it over because I just thought it was. I thought it was something different than it was.
Right.
It's one of those movies where you can't know what it is until you watch it.
So watch it.
Yeah.
Tonight.
And get your hankies ready.
You guys still here?
Are your, Robert.
Are your eardrums okay?
Turn that piano down.
Just turn it down.
It's one of those pianos with a volume knob. Is Robert Loggia playing the piano now? Yes. I thought he was just the janitor. he got promoted.
Look, our piano player, he just couldn't take it anymore, so he left. You know what that music means?
Yeah, the show's over.
Time to hand out our prizes. You get a trip to the... The African room.
Oh, good. For dancing and dining?
Yeah.
Excellent.
And Chris, as a consolation prize, you get this set of knives.
Oh!
That will later be used to kill someone.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I guess that, like, if it weren't for the, what's it called? The game show, none of this would have happened.
Oh, maybe that kind of gives the game show a reason for existing.
Yeah, it sets the scene.
All right, so we're talking about Brian De Palma's sisters today on the Cutprint Film Podcast.
That feels like ages ago.
Oh. Next week, we're going to be talking about Blowout.
Right.
What year was that made?
I should have
2011's Blowout by Brian De Palma.
It was 2025's Blowout from the future.
That's right.
So, to play along at home, if you haven't seen Blowout, go out, rent it. It's also, I think it's on Hulu Plus because it's a Criterion film. So
okay.
It should be on.
That's
there.
How I'll be watching.
Yes.
It.
I'll be getting it from the library. Like a schnook.
It has another name, Collateral Damage.
No,
with
that's
Arnold Schwarzenegger. So just watch that.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wasn't he in that? Collateral Damage?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Collateral.
Yeah, that's what
Tom Cruise had a gray haired wig.
Play that piano, man.
Is there anyone at home should be listening to? Other than us, obviously.
Here's who you can listen to.
And their parents.
You can listen to antifanboy.com. They have a podcast about comic books and zoo animals. You can also listen to the Joystick Jerks.
Yeah, I
was going to say, they do a podcast exclusively about episodes of Friends and Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah.
So listen to Joystick Jerks and Anti-Fanboy.
Joystick Jerks have a Kickstarter going right now.
Yes.
They want to reach their goal, but donate anyway.
Yes. Yeah. They've exceeded their goal by $200, but why not pump more money into them?
Why ever stop?
Who else?
Now we're coming to the end.
Oh, morelikeradio.com. There you go.
They exist.
But we don't to them.
No, we're dead to them. We're like a lame horse.
So, you know, just think on those things that we said.
Just let's make out.
All of them.
Yeah.
Good night.
We love you. Have a great time on your iPod going to the next podcast you're going to listen to.
Or listen to this one again.